welcome to show 38 of the Retro Computing Roundtable, recorded Sunday, November 11th, 2012.
But no matter where I go,
RCR audio files are hosted by CyberEars. They can host your podcast or audio files too. Go to cyberears.com for more details. I'm Earl Evans. You might know me from such roles as Dirk in the Where'd You Go episode of Who's Your Mama? Or as the fifth runner-up in Survivor Portland. And along with me is Carrington Vanston in Toronto, Canada, lover of fine art and cheese roll-ups.
You got that backwards. There, I'm actually a lover of fine cheese and art roll-ups.
Nice. It's close. Nice. Well, you could have corrected the show, Doc.
Right. Dirk. You went as Dirk and Who's Your Mama? Where do you come up with something like that?
It's too much caffeine, I told you. I tweeted that the other day.
Okay.
I must cut down. So, items of interest. First off, those watching and listening are probably going, where is David? And so, sadly, I have to announce David is taking a break from the RCR. Basically, he's been piled on, buried alive with different things that he's trying to do. Very similar to, weren't we talking on the RCR recently about Ken Gagne and how
exactly. David has pulled a Gagne.
And, you know, Ken had wondered, you know, I've got all these things that I'm trying to accomplish. How should I prioritize them? How should I put them together? David's gone through a similar experience here. And one of the things that has had to fall out for the time being is the RCR. But we're keeping a spot for him at the round table, because if we didn't, it would become something like a rectangular table.
Or right. A very small table.
Yeah, it'd be, you know, more like a TV tray.
So, tell the truth, Earl. You lost David in poker.
I did.
Earl was playing poker and he bet our David.
Just because I'm terrible at Texas Hold'em. So, but, you know, I'm hoping to win him back.
Right. Which is much nicer than the truth, which is simply that Earl has pawned David. You had that spoken, and I can't believe you actually went ahead and did that. I'm ashamed. So, I'm ashamed to podcast.
Well, it was that or the Commodore pet, and I just, you know, sorry, David.
Makes sense. Who's going to give you anything for a pet?
Yeah. So, yeah, lots of irons in the fire right now. So life is crazy for David. We don't have a specific return date for David to come back, but he could pop in at any time. I mean, like in 1 minute, he could just spontaneously jump in.
So if anybody out there can do a good impression of David and you're free every second Sunday, give us a call.
Well, actually, I kind of have that covered. I'm currently hard at work on a real-time virtual David simulator.
That would be easy. Is that it running behind you right now? The thing looping the RCR words?
No, that's a prototype.
God, okay, because it's pretty accurate already. That's David tweeting.
RCR. Yeah, that's true. For those who can't see, which is most of you, I've got a Commodore 128 sitting behind me that is printing a dot matrix-ish version of RCR for our video folks. Because I just wanted to have, you know, a little bit of ambiance. But when I get the real-time David simulator done, then, I'm not sure what'll happen. He'll probably get into the internet and take over the world and become Skynet.
That's David. We have a couple of interesting comments so far. First is that we have been reduced to a one-dimensional table, which is very funny.
Yes.
excellent comment there. And also, in other items, grumpier than that says, in other items of interest, Carrington's mic is huge.
Oh, somebody noticed then, did they?
I am indeed using this compensation mic. It is my old Yeti. What is it? It's the Blue Yeti, and I'm using it because I'm testing out the Yeti, here, I'll lift it up, the shock mount, this massive dinner plate size shock mount called the Rotor or something. I don't know. It's the Blue Yeti's shock mount, also made by Blue. It's huge. Huge mic, huge shock mount. I like the mic, but holy cow, is this a big shock mount. I just like to test out new podcasting gear, so I'm giving this one a shot for this show.
Well, and it's working very well, because your voice is extremely well modulated. In fact, I couldn't believe it was you.
I can't believe it's not butter.
So while you have that great mic to talk into, why don't you tell us about running Windows 8 on a Commodore 64?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was an article recently, I think just a couple days ago, in PC World about how to do exactly that, how to optimize Windows 8 on old hardware. They picked an one of those EPCs, sort of a 5 or 6 year old laptop. And as you would know, those systems weren't exactly super powerful even when they came out. And what I liked about this was it sort of jives with what a lot of us do when it comes to retro systems, in that we take old systems and try to get them to work in modern times, usually not trying to get necessarily a modern operating system to work on them, but to get them to run in modern day. And I thought it was interesting that a PC magazine, PC World, would take that sort of approach, but not for a retro computing audience, but for a general audience, and say, you know, a new operating system has come out that's exciting and modern and different. How can we get a relatively retro system to work with that? So it was interesting to see sort of their approach and what you have to strip down, and to read that article with the mindset of a retro computing user, how we're often trying to look at how do I maximize RAM or how do I get something to work at all. So it was interesting to see a modern approach to what I think of as a retro problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reductionist approach. Well, for instance, if you look behind me here, to the left, or maybe to your right, I'm not sure, that mirror effect always gets me, but you'll see a little blinking light over on the side of the computer. What that blinking light is, it's a prototype of a device called a Commodore Flyer, and it connects the Commodore to the internet, and it lets you store your programs up on a cloud server and retrieve them from there and that kind of thing. When I wrote this little RCR program, I actually used that Commodore Flyer to store it out to the internet. It's an example, again, like you were saying, of creatively trying to figure out how do we take this old hardware and make it do a modern thing, like store stuff up on the cloud. It's innovation, and it's one of the things that I think I miss most from the 80s, is that in the 80s you had this like Cambrian explosion of personal computers, you know, the genetic material flying all over the place, and people would throw different things up against the wall to see what would stick and what wouldn't. And so in this case, you've got Microsoft doing something crazy different, and maybe it'll stick, maybe it'll flop, who knows, right. But I agree with you. It's kind of nice to see somebody trying something out, and we'll see what happens. I've tweeted about this. I happen to really like the user interface of it, and maybe part of that is just liking new stuff, but part of it is I like the way that it flies. So, and yeah, man, in the 80s, you could barely keep up. There were different types of things coming out all the time, and people swiping ideas from each other. It was very interesting.
Yeah. So, and I think you're right that you don't see that as much now, because in the 80s, we still hadn't decided on a paradigm. Everybody was still making up their interfaces. And so just right. Throwing things out there from the big operating system right down to just, you know, how should you interact with a word processor, and things finally did shake down. And it makes sense that it's difficult for the general public to use things if every single time is different. If, like, you know, I couldn't even figure out how to open my refrigerator because, oh, no, don't, you know, we got this operating system. And it's like, I just want a drink. What's going on? So it makes sense that eventually, if you want an industry to develop, it has to standardize on things. But I still, being an old dude who was there at the beginning, long for those days.
It's kind of fascinating because when you think about things where we're used to the interface, like you get in a car and the steering wheel's in front of you, brake pedal on the left, accelerator on the right, you kind of...
I'm going to get to work so much faster tomorrow.
That kind of thing. You wouldn't want all that to be swapped out if you got in another car. You wouldn't want everything to be all screwy. That, you know, so the good part is you could jump in almost any car and drive it. The bad part is you don't get any kind of quantum leap in the user interface of a car, right? Because we're so stuck in the paradigm that we have that a car is a car is a car. And you just never – so, I like for people to try new things. Well, mm-hmm. I guess Google is trying the let's let the car drive itself.
Right, and, that new?
Yeah, that's very new. And, you know, hopefully nobody will get run over.
Hopefully.
But we should move on to the next thing, which is the Living Computer Museum.
I want to go so badly.
Oh, me too. Me too. I want to see it now that they've opened it up to the public. So this is Paul Allen's baby up in Seattle. It's the Living Computer Museum. They've got lots of different computers, computing artifacts, that kind of thing. And one of their claim to fame is these things run. They operate. Not only that, but you can walk up to them and you can do things with them. You can interact with them. You can feel what it was like to use a teletype from back in the day. You can feel what it was like to use those old operating systems and that sort of thing. Now, the Seattle Retro Computing Society met at those premises, and so one of the lucky things is we got to see the Living Computer Museum as it was in the process of construction, and it was really fascinating to see everything come together. Now they've opened it to the public, and I unfortunately haven't had the chance to get up there since the official professional displays have opened up, but I'm looking forward to it the first chance I get. We've got a link for it here in the show notes, including a link on geekwire.com that itself has an embedded video of some of the coverage that King 5's a local TV station up in the Seattle area, and they did some nice coverage of the Living Computer Museum, showed you around a bit and talked about what they've got there. So if you're interested, definitely take a look. And if you're anywhere over here on the left coast, you should try to make it up to Seattle to take a look. The admission price is really cheap. Now, if you are somewhere else in the world and you're thinking, gosh, I don't think I'm going to get to Seattle anytime soon, don't count yourself out from participating, because the Living Computer Museum offers you the ability to get a login account for some of their vintage mainframe systems.
Time on a VAX.
You can have time on an old classic VAX VMS system. You can have time on a PDP-10. I have accounts on there. I like to log in. Carrington and I were talking before the show. Over this weekend, I had logged into the VAX, and I was playing with their different language compilers that they have on this machine. I wrote a Hello World program in Ada and in COBOL, Fortran.
And Fortran, you were saying. Yeah, you were saying how Fortran is the first computer language you had learned.
In what today we call middle school, then we called junior high, the best we could do for a while was to fill out programs on punch cards. And they weren't even really punch cards. They were more mark sense cards. You take a pencil and mark in the Hollow Earth codes. And then
did the exact same thing.
And then you'd send them off to the school district mainframe, Los Angeles Unified, and a couple days later you'd get the results. So you literally had a 2-day turnaround to find out whether your program worked.
I don't even know what system it was. It was so long ago, but we had some sort of system we were using to learn early languages using the same thing, some sort of mark sense card, but it was processed in the school. So we actually would get our stuff back the next class. So we would fill out our programs on Monday, and we would have our printouts on Tuesday. So
very good.
Yeah, which is crazy that seems fast. Like nowadays, you'd be like, hey, it only took 24 hours.
Yeah, I don't have my program back in 20 milliseconds. What's going on here?
So it is kind of bonkers, but yeah.
But it's really fun to log into the system and poke around. So livingcomputermuseum.org, that's one word, Living Computer Museum. And obviously we'll have the link up in the show notes. And check out some of the photos that they have also.
The photos are drool-worthy. The photos just make me want to go so badly. I'm dying to get to this thing.
Is it fair to say that they're kind of deck-centric? They have various different companies represented there, but they have a pretty nice focus on the deck equipment, the PDP-10, PDP-11, the VAX, and to actually stand in the room and see those old beautiful cabinets like they were back in the day, it's such a treat to see those things in operation. So anyway, moving on. Carrington, what do you have here to tell us about the internet being a First Amendment right?
Well, this I found quite interesting and controversial, so we'll sort of avoid the controversy, even though I do love to stir the pot. But there was recently a court case in the U.S. where a 15-year-old was convicted of molestation. But what's appropriate to talk about here, I think, on RCR is that the judge ruled that the 50-year-old and presumably everybody in America has a First Amendment right to access Facebook and Twitter and social media and the internet in general. So this idea that somebody convicted of even a felony or a crime, not even just computer-based, but anything, can no longer be denied access to something technological. And I thought it was interesting because my first thought was to think back to things like Kevin Mitnick and Mafia Boy and earlier convictions where
they
usually
kicked
it was
off.
The case. Exactly. Yeah. Where I remember with Mitnick for the longest time, and I think he got it overruled, but he wasn't allowed access to anything even remotely like a computer. He could use a landline telephone and that was it. No modems, no anything. And it's funny how in a relatively short period, we've moved to a judge now saying, oh, gosh, no, you could never take somebody away from Facebook. That's a fundamental, necessary way for humans to communicate. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, they were saying, oh, that's it. No modems, no anything for you. You get a rotary telephone and that's all. Go. It's not integral to being part of society. So it's interesting how far we've moved in that courts are now changing judgments so much.
It's kind of moved from a secondary form of communication, something that could be seen as optional, to a primary form of communication. Like, I wonder what sort of precedent there was in the past for restricting someone's right to use a telephone or to use the U.S. mail or to go to a meeting where other people would be, or, you know, something, other forms of interpersonal communication.
Right.
That,
and you guys just had a big election in the States, and it's
we did,
not like, and well,
actually,
you have computer voting.
Did that make the news?
It did. It makes the news in every other country that you could destroy. So us up in Canada, we do watch what happens down there because, you know, we live
nice
in
to keep
chat.
An eye on things. Yeah, yes. I agree.
Our country may sit on your country, but we're still interested in what's happening down below. But it's not the case, for instance, that you have computerized voting down there in a lot of areas, it seems. It's not like you can pull out your iPhone and vote. It's not like you vote over the internet. So
right.
There
and
isn't
in a case,
something like that
in a
going
case
on.
In New Jersey where a certain amount of that, I think, was tried this time to accommodate people because of Hurricane Sandy. And that, you know, so listeners will probably correct me if I'm off on this, but I think some amount of that communication was permitted over email. I have to read up on it. I just remember seeing that, you know, it was like sticking a toe in the water. Maybe that's a bad metaphor, given that it was because of the hurricane. But you know what I mean. I mean, right. You know, like a little movement in that direction. But no, we can't vote from a mobile device. We can't vote from our computer at home. I've often thought about that and wondered how in the world would you make that happen? It seems like there's so many logistical security issues with that. Mm-hmm.
But what I found interesting was, so it wasn't that things are going on in American society at the moment, that if you removed access to the internet, somebody would lose other fundamental rights. So it wasn't the case that, oh, if you don't have that, they can't vote, which you can't take away. Or if they don't have that, they can't. No, it was just that it's now being seen as a fundamental right in that society to communicate with others through this medium, like, which is such a fundamental difference to what was before. Like, nobody batted an eye to take away Mitnick's right to use a computer modem. And now they say, oh, God, you couldn't bar, like, the judge specifically said, you can't forbid somebody from getting on Facebook. And so just the idea that judges would know about that and then say, it's such a different world than 1980s. And so I spent so much of my life arguing about the importance of computers and as a means of expression, as means of communication, all those things. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting to see that suddenly what feels like out of nowhere, there's a major court case that sort of took that side. Because we grew up watching movies like, I remember like Hackers and Tough Turf and that kind of stuff, movies where kids were, it opens with this idea that some kid had a past and so therefore it's been judged that he can't get on the net or he can't use modems. And now it's like something like, well, you can't have that plot anymore because it's just, it's been decided that Twitter is a fundamental First Amendment right. I thought it was interesting.
Fascinating. And, you know, we're in the high-tech field, the computer field, so we kind of get used to the notion of things moving quickly. But when you think about it from a societal standpoint, man, that is just lightning speed for that kind of fundamental change. Which I guess is basically what you said. But I mean, it just you got to shake your head and go, wow.
But was there ever a case, for instance, I don't know, like historically, here's where we need David. Here's where we need an actual computer historian on with us. David, answer this. Because was there a case, say, in the States or in Western civilization where a form of technology was deemed to be like the technology itself is the use of that a First Amendment right for communication? Like, was it ever the case that a judge said you can't ban somebody from using a typewriter because using a typewriter is a First Amendment right? Because there's ways to communicate in America if you're not on the internet. People are right now not on the internet, so you can live without it. I can't imagine I would go into withdrawals myself. But
right.
It's interesting that said, no, this technology, this technology that is itself decades old now and we've been using forever has now been recognized as something that is a fundamental right that you cannot take away. Whereas we could take away typewriters, we could take away other things, but dear Lord, you cannot take away Twitter.
Nobody better try to take away my typewriter. That's all I'm saying.
That's such an American thing to say. You pry it from a cool dead keyboard.
That's right.
Oh, you Americans.
Just stay away from my
typewriter. So I just thought, well, it's not a particularly retro topic. It did for me, this whole thing resonated with retroness because I remember all the hacker cases where somebody had been previously sentenced to being able to use a computer, not being able to use the internet. And this was the first time where I was like, exactly. So this represents a watershed change in the way that's being viewed within in the broader society. And I remember it being different for most of my life and most of my time with computers. So
I was listening to the audiobook Ghost in the Wires, Kevin Mitnick's.
I read that as well.
And even though they tried to keep him out of networks, tried to keep him off of online systems, it didn't work anyway. I mean, I guess I could make the argument that even if you do have a legal precedent for keeping somebody off the internet, you may not have, unless you just keep them under watch 24 hours a day, you probably don't have a practical way to keep them.
In the same way that I think DRM is impossible to actually enforce this kind of thing, keep somebody off the net, you know, go and try. How would one do that?
It's just not going to work.
Couldn't keep me off the net, that's for sure.
Although we've tried. We've tried every way we know.
You try, but I keep coming back.
Just, like the bad penny.
Yep.
So, hey, let's talk about the P112 single board computer.
And the $170 option?
This is a Kickstarter. And I'm going to refresh it here to see if this has changed since we started the show. It has not. Well, so listen, gang, as of the recording of the RCR right now at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, November 11th.
Or 4:30 p.m. real time.
Yes, that's right, Canadian time. This Kickstarter has $6,159 pledged. It needs $8,000 to make it. So that is $1,841 that they need real soon. If you're interested in one of these P112 Z180, it's not a Z80, it's a Z180 as I recall. Or is it a Z280? I better scroll down and understand what the heck
I'm talking about. It's a Z1.5 80. He split the difference.
It's a Z180 microprocessor. Can run CPM and other stuff. And the last time a run of these came out, they were very popular. And so it's interesting. This one, man, it's close to making it. But I don't know. I don't know if they're going to make it. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, less than 2,000 left to go. So not a ton of people would have to pledge to make this thing a reality.
That's true.
So what do we need? Like 12 people. So yeah. 11 or 12 people.
Yeah, if they got the full kit,
this would go. Yeah, exactly. So not a ton of people have to go off and pledge.
And that was actually a nice addition to the Kickstarter, to get the full kit for 170, so that you don't have to run around and nickel and dime it at Mauser or other. Not that those places are bad. In fact, I've heard good things about mm-hmm. those distributors. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of a pain to have to go chase around all the parts you need to build something. It's nice that for 170 you could get the full meal deal.
And that said, and while I don't think for the, as you say, full meal deal, the 170 is an outrageous price. Like I really do not think that. But I also understand that's a chunk of change. Like that's not.
It is. That's a bit of money.
That's what's holding, I think, a lot. It's really too bad that this couldn't have been made in a way that for $50. You got this item, because I do think that, well, it would have taken three times more people, four times more people pledging, four times more people can pledge $50 or $25 than can pledge $170. That's for an item that isn't exactly the case. I'm going to get this and it's going to become my primary computer. What a bargain. This is still a hobby item. It's still, you know, so, well, I really want one. I get the reluctance of people to drop $170 to pick one of these up.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably a mid-tier hobbyist item. You know, it's interesting that I would put the new CFFA card into that same category. I would say that for 100, it's 150, right, for that
right.
card. So
yes.
I would say that, you know, all I've ever heard is people gushing over that device. Like, this is the best thing since sliced bread. It's even better than sliced bread, and I have no reason to doubt that, and I like my Apple II computer. I just, $150 is a price point where I have to think about it.
Yes, you know? Exactly, because there isn't anything you can do with a CFFA 3000, for instance, 2000, some thousand, that you couldn't do without it. I mean, because you can still run all the same software, you can still get disk images, you can still use ADD Pro and hook it up, but it adds so much convenience, and it's awesome, but it really is a luxury item. It's completely you can get everything, because people had Apple IIs back in the day without it, and played a lot of software. Certainly, I did as a kid, often without paying for any of it. So it's not like it is very, and the same sort of thing. So when you look at these items that are hobby items, it's sometimes, especially if you've got a wife or something. I'm single, so I can drop my money on these ridiculous things, which might be why I'm single. But you know, if somebody's married, they're like, "What are you going to justify to the wife? What do you mean you just dropped $170 on a Z80 single board computer?"
No, it's true. It's true. I think it's funny because it's just kind of coalescing in my head here that I think there's three different levels I would probably put it into. In my mind, it feels like three tiers. One is that
– a lot of tears.
Yeah, yeah, you know, shedding many tears. So there's the Raspberry Pi. And I really want one of these Raspberry Pi computers. In fact, a local outfit, I think it's here in the States, MCM Electronics, will sell you a package of the Pi and a case and a power supply and the operating system on an SD card and all that for 60-something, 70-something. I mean, then you got to factor in a little bit of shipping. But, you know, that's like the kind of money that, okay, I could probably just spend that and not have to worry too much about it.
Right. It's not gum, but it's not it's still only two digits.
Right. Then the middle tier, you know, the 100 to 300-400 kind of range where, like you say, this is a luxury item. This is something that I won't say that I won't get something within that range, but I will say that I won't get a lot of things within that range. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I need to pick and choose. And then you see folks that private collections, they buy things like we saw the last time we did the show, that industrial PDP-8 computer that went for 4,000 something.
Yeah.
You know, somebody, I don't think, I don't know for sure. Somebody correct me if you know that I'm wrong, but I don't think that went to a museum.
And that's the thing is, we're not talking about the sort of items like when you look at the Apple ones being auctioned, the hundreds of that, like those are a different thing, like these massive collectible museum pieces. When something is $4,000, it's not going to a museum. It's really going to some guy who's adding it, or girl who's adding it to his basement collection. And that's like, it happens all the time. Like on eBay, all the time I'll see things go for thousands of dollars.
And it's amazing to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. And
but that person wanted that particular computer. They saved their pennies. You know, maybe they're retired. They're like, ooh, this would be fun to have. And, you know, I've got a chunk of discretionary change. But I have never
done
that. And
what else are you going to spend it on? I mean, the reality is, too, like I drop coin on this kind of stuff sometimes in a way that I'm like, did I really spend that on this item? But it's my hobby and I enjoy doing it. And you know, if you get to an age where you're, a lot of us collectors are doing it and we've liked this stuff from the 80s. So it's a nostalgic love. If you've been employed for that time, you can also have the disposable income. If you're lucky enough to say, well, yeah, I dropped a few $100 or a couple $1,000 even on something. And you know, instead of taking it, other people say, no, I took a trip I took a trip to Italy for the week. So no, I didn't take a trip to Italy for the week. I bought this motherboard. And just, it's a different priority or just a different thing to spend your money on.
Perspective. That's an interesting way to think about it.
I should get some of that. I hear good things about perspective.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I try to avoid it as much as I can, but
does Zaphod Beeblebrox.
But when you think about it, there's a buddy of mine that's into Jeeps. You know, going out and doing Jeep things with the Jeep.
Manly 4x4ing.
Exactly. And cool. Some of the pictures that I've seen from him out doing the 4x4 stuff are just incredible. Looks like a lot of fun. But you're going to drop a significant amount of money in that kind of hobby. You know, you're going to get the Jeep. You're going to trick it out. You're going to
lift
have,
it and winch
you're
going
to have to repair it. You know, when when you break it, which yeah, it looks like some of the stuff they do, they take a pretty good chance of that. So you think about that money, or people who do the RVs. I think we talked about that before. You know, even some of the extreme hobbyists in remote control craft, like remote control aircraft, that stuff doesn't come cheap.
No, it's crazy. But I think it is about priorities and. For those of us who listen to the RCR, like our type of people, the priority is sometimes it's that stuff. It's like it's, you know, flying airplanes is cool, but for me it wouldn't have the nostalgic aspect that getting a tricked out bit of Apple II gear does. Something that
exactly.
I really wanted when I was 14 and now can have. You know, that's a long time to want something and just, you know, you can get I often think back to that guy who made the news when he bought the Apple IIc for a couple $1,000 and then opened it up.
One.
And everyone's like, how can you do that? And I totally understood how he could do that. I'm like, I love to rip stuff open, as people would know from my podcast, but I totally get how what he was buying wasn't just a 2C. It was that experience. And a big chunk of what he paid for was I'm going to get to purchase a new Apple IIc right now and to open it up and have that out-of-box experience. And I really see a value in that. So I totally understood it, even though everyone was making fun of them. So.
And how many people get to do that these days?
Yep.
So there you go. Speaking of the Apple IIc and Apples in general, did I hear something about Kansas Fest?
Kansas Fest, never heard of it. That sounds like a tier 3 thing. Who would ever spend their money on that?
That's above the $300-$400
totally.
Range.
Like it's a chunk
okay,
of we
so
got
I take
lucky
it back.
Last year.
I take it back. I have done that kind of thing.
Yeah, you have. And we got lucky last year because we got a sponsor
Indeed.
Who paid for Yumi and David to go down there. So we got really, really lucky. Oh, thank you, Navis. That was awesome of them. Maybe they'll sponsor us again. That'd be good. But even if not, I'm really committed to going again. And Kansas
Fest. I'm saving my pennies.
Me too. And Kansas Fest has just announced the dates for next year, so everybody can mark it on your calendar. It's going to be July 23rd to 28th. It usually falls in and around that week in July. So it didn't surprise me that that's when they picked. And one of the nice things about this, so we got July 23rd to 28th, 2013 will be next Kansas Fest. And that means that just like last year, it does not overlap with Comic-Con. So sometimes people will complain to say, well, you have to pick between the two. Now you get to go to both. So you can go to Comic-Con and then in costume, just head on over to Kansas City, Missouri and hang out with us and talk retro stuff all dressed up like Master Chief or whatever.
And luckily, it also doesn't intersect with my trip to Japan that I'm
lucky duck you
next year. And I was worried because it looked like the dates were maybe going to be kind of close, but and they are kind of close, but they're not the same. So I am still saving up. as fast and furiously as I can. We keep going on and on about Kansas Fest. People, you know, probably think we're like the Kansas Fest cult or something like that. But
wasn't it
so awesome?
Yeah,
just amazingly awesome.
And the guy, I'm so appreciative of all the people that put crazy amounts of effort into making this thing exist, because I don't do anything. Like, I'm well, you know, at the last Kansas Fest, we did presentations. We did an RCR presentation and individual ones. But that's not really a lot of work. For the most part, we show up and you spend half an hour talking. What's the big deal? In fact, my solo presentation. But my solo presentation, if you recall, was about Inform 7. And the whole point of it was to show how fast you can learn and do Inform 7. So I basically taught it to myself for the few hours in the morning while Ken was talking and then did the presentation. That's how little effort I put in this last year. I feel kind of guilty about it. But some people do put crazy amounts of behind-the-scenes effort arranging it and organizing everything and getting a keynote speaker and all of that. So I'm so appreciative that somebody is willing to step up and do that so I get to just go and hang out and have fun. So.
We absolutely do appreciate that. And even though I haven't been to some of the other events, like the various vintage computer festivals or the Convex show in Vegas and that kind of thing, I do know from talking to some of the people, it's another of those situations. It's not like a Kansas Fest because it's not the dorm room kind of experience, but it still takes an enormous amount of preparation, organization, work, you know, time that it's just people being givers. And
it's the dorm room thing that really, to me, separates. The reason I want to go to Kansas Fest, and I will skip a lot of the other ones, which would no doubt be fun, is there's something truly unique about living for 5 days with a bunch of retro people in a dorm. It feels nostalgic because you're back living in a dorm. Like, even that, the whole experience is nostalgic. It's like, oh my God, I'm back at university. But just to be immersed in it for a few days and like eating with these people and hanging out at night is such a different experience than going for like a weekend show or something. So I can't recommend it enough.
Yep. And so it's coming up. So everybody will be talking about it as it gets closer. And as things like registration opens and some of the things are announced, like keynote speaker and that, we'll make sure to keep everybody in the loop.
Yep, we will be looped.
Have you heard about this really different software magazine called Input? It's a weekly course that program by program will help you get the most from your computer. And it's designed specially for many of the leading computers. Input's clear instructions will show you how to use a simple 4-next loop to create clever routines. And week by week will improve your programming skills so you can use your computer both practically and imaginatively. Oh, very clever. Input. Learn to program for fun and the future.
I should talk about a retro geek gift.
Yes, you should. What are you going to buy me, Earl?
You can look at the webpage. You can see it's on its way. In fact, that would
ruin surprise.
That knock at the door right now, that's this arriving. It is a giant LED table lamp.
How giant is giant?
It's enormous.
Enormous is giant.
Yes, it is a gigantic. They should have put gigantic. Just giant doesn't quite do it justice. So it's like a humongous LED that you run off of 3 AAA cells, and you can either, apparently according to the comments, you can set it to a color, or you can have it cycle through colors. And I think if I'm reading it right, it actually does run off LEDs, but it looks like a giant LED, and it has legs that are flexible.
And they look like pins, but just massive. So people like, just like, I'm looking at this picture and to paint a word picture, as I say, for our audio listeners, it's crazy to look at this thing that's like a couple of feet tall, but just looks like an enormous single LED with little pins on the bottom, bent so it sits on those. Fantastic look. I've definitely not seen this before. So,
I know that we have kind of an affinity for ThinkGeek. A number of our geek gifts have come off here, but it's just because they've got such cool stuff. Let's just face it. And so I would like to have one of these. In fact, I may put this on my Christmas list.
Ooh, fancy.
So, yeah, it'd be a nice – I could have it behind me here in the when we do the RCR.
I really like it. I think it's an excellent choice. It'll make a good addition to our retro computing gift guide. I will remind everybody that we have that. You can head over to rcrpodcast.com and you'll see the little, there's a little retro computing lovers gift buying guide. And each time we select an item, I add it to that list. So when it is time to shop for birthdays and for Christmas and stuff,
like for us, that, for instance, when you want to buy us gifts,
as everybody should want to, obviously, but it's just, it's a handy little thing. So every time we select one of these, it gets added to that gift. So you don't, the gift guide. So you don't have to necessarily try to jot down or remember everything. Just head over to rcrpodcast.com and you can see all of the gift choices we made since the beginning of the show.
Well, I love, you know, in the show notes, my eBay thing is ahead of yours, but I think I want to go let you go first because I love this Mac Cube that you picked.
No problem. I will happily leap in. So, yes, so in our auctions, and to let people know, Earl and I have been talking about it. We're going to start dropping the whole reviewing last time's auctions because if you're really interested, you can pop in yourself. If it's something newsworthy, like if we pick something and then it goes for $35,000 or something ridiculous, or there's a story or a reason to revisit it, then obviously we will. But for the most part, it's just, it's an auction. And if you were interested, you would go bookmark. So we thought, let's just speed through. So for this time, I have selected, as Earl just intimated, a Mac Cube. And what I like about this Mac Cube is, like, I've picked a few things like this before when we were doing auction picks, where I like to pick a thing that gives you, you know, like one and done. You make the purchase and you're finished. So this has a buy it now of basically $370, $369.50, but it has a make an offer button. And what you get is a Mac Cube and the appropriate Apple monitor from the time, that look they had that was the white kind of color with the clear legs. So it's got the, and those Mac Cube speakers, the little round crystal clear balls, and the appropriate keyboard, the one that was the clear keyboard with the black keys, and the appropriate mouse, the one that was the clear mouse but with the black on the inside instead of the white on the inside. So it's got the full, it's the full, you know, everything complete Mac Cube kit, fully functional and also tricked out. So I like the fact that he's upgraded it. So it's got 1.5 gigs RAM, I think it was. Yeah, 1.5 gigs RAM, 160 gig internal hard drive. The DVD burner is even got iLife installed. It's fully functional. Needs a new battery because it's not holding the time when it restarts, but that's an easy thing. And the Mac Cube, which was one of the, you know, one of the all-time great form factors for the Apple, and also the one that looks most like a Kleenex box. But I always really liked it. But there was a sort of an inherent manufacturing defect where a lot of them, the clear outsides, would get cracks along the corners. And this one seems to not have those. So I looked, and it really looks like it's in good kit. And it's hard to get one of these that isn't really spider cracked up all the corners. So this one looks almost like new. So it's a really nice, you know, complete set. So if you're interested in a Mac Cube for $370, again, tier three, like not, this is not necessarily an impulse buy, but it gets you a tricked out, upgraded full system with the speakers and the keyboard and the mouse and the monitor and the whole deal, fully functional without all the cracks on the side. So it's like one and done. It really caught my eye as a, like, if I was interested in a Mac Cube, I would have probably pulled the trigger on this. I don't think it's an outrageous price, and I think it's a really good auction. So this is what I'm picking, Mac Cube for the Mac Cube buyer.
It's such a beautiful machine. I don't understand why nobody makes a computer that is in the same genre anymore.
I think it's just too expensive. I mean, even Apple went for the Mac Mini, which is the same thing minus all the extra, like that whole supporting Pyrex outside shell thing on the Cube isn't really functional. It's just there to make it look pretty, and I love it, but that adds a lot of expense. The Mac Mini is sort of the same computer, but with, you know, more power and that outside case removed.
That's true.
Yeah.
And everything gets smaller,
right.
But man, it's pretty looking.
It is, and it's unique. Like, the Mac Cube is one of those, it's like the 20th anniversary Mac. It's one of the Macs that stands out as unique in the history of Apple's designs. So if you're putting together a collection of Macintoshes through the years, the Mac Cube is a standout. Like, I don't think anybody with a collection needs to get every Performa ever made because you can't even tell them apart. But you want to get, like, if you want to get the iconic ones, you want to get the 20th century. You want to get the SE30. You want to get, like, the first Mac. And you want to get a cube. Like, a cube to me is one of the, you'd want to get like one of the LC series. I think the LC475 or the Quadro 605, same computer, that kind of stuff. Like, there's certain ones that I think were great computers, if in this case limited by speed. But I think the cube is one of the great designs of computers, Apple or otherwise. So for less than $400, you get yourself a beautiful piece of kit.
Now, could you refresh my memory? The cube was circa when?
2009. I don't know.
I don't think it was that recent.
I think it was 2001, something like that. So let me look. It was, discontinued in July 2001. So it's a 2000 and 2001 thing. It wasn't around for very long. There weren't a lot of models of them, I think.
And maybe we take a pause here before I do my eBay thing. Do we have any other comments?
The problem is, I've commented on YouTube, in fact, that it seems for me, the YouTube comments have kind of cacked out. Other people were saying that, I've just restarted it. Maybe they're arguing. But I haven't been able to see comments for a while, and it looks like there are a whole bunch, and I've been missing them. Sorry, I guess I should have restarted the browser. Safari just sort of froze on me for a bit. There's lots
darn
of comments.
YouTube. Come on.
I'll read those while you talk about your auction item, and then I'll talk about comments.
Okay, that sounds good. So here's something that I know almost nothing about, but am fascinated by. My eBay auction is a Symbolics 3640 artificial intelligence workstation. They say here in the auction that it's complete and functional, and I've always heard about the Symbolics Lisp machines and their unique niche in the world of computing and artificial intelligence, how they were used in a research capacity and stuff like that. But I know almost nothing about them. And I was thinking, wow, the starting bid for this complete system is $150. Now, it's got 6 days, so I imagine it's going to get a lot more bids than zero, and the price will probably go up quite a bit. But at the moment, wow, that's kind of affordable. So if you're just like idly curious about this, I looked at some of the pictures on Wikipedia and elsewhere, the Symbolics machine, really interesting keyboard, really interesting look to the hardware.
The whole stand-up cabinet computer look is gorgeous. And I can see me doing something with this right at like my front door, where you come in and it's used for something.
And that thing's sitting there processing. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It's really awesome. Because cool. This has a different look to a typical computer. I mean, it's not like a massive, you know, looking at like a big mainframe computer, but this is a whole cabinet and a stand up thing and stuff. So pretty cool.
And this was mid 80s, and Symbolics, I read a little bit about them. They were actually something that came out of MIT and then, you know, spun off into a business and began to make these, and I guess had some moderate success. Again, is kind of a niche, you know, this artificial intelligence and Lisp. I still have nightmares about Lisp. My AI class that I took as part of my computer science degree, I did have to learn and become somewhat fluent with Lisp, and it's just this bizarre kind of backwards to the middle way of thinking about coding. And it became clear to me why it would be interesting in artificial intelligence, but man, it was just clawing my way uphill.
Yeah, I remember working with Lisp, and mostly what I got out of it was, with my classmates who were also learning Lisp, we made lots of Lisp speak jokes where we, instead of saying, "Are you hungry?" we would just say "food pee" and that kind of stuff. And that's really all I ever got out of it was Lisp makes jokes for other people who know a rudimentary bit of Lisp. That's as far as I got.
You know, the interesting thing is, if you get one little thing out of something that you learn in computer science, that's better than nothing. Right,
like
if you, just one little different way of looking at things, and Lisp will definitely give that to you.
Right.
So, but anyway, like you say, the one and done kind of thing.
Right.
This is in that same category.
Now, are you worried though? I mean, at the moment, this has, I guess, no bids, right? And it's at $150. But if it's a good enough artificial intelligence system, isn't it going to bid itself up?
It may, yeah.
So that's the problem. How do you even buy this thing? It's always going to outbid you for itself.
I have three rules for sentient systems.
Asimov.
After watching all these movies, I came up with my Earl's three rules.
Got it. Tell us Earl's three rules.
A, you don't connect them to the internet.
A, so there's 26 rules, but okay.
B, you don't give them any means of movement, no arms and legs.
Right.
And C, this is the most important one of all, you don't give them weapons.
Right. Do not arm them. Don't make them mobile. Don't let them get on the internet. But how do you stop it from getting on the internet? We talked earlier about how if something wants on the internet, it's going to get on. And when it's on the internet, if it's in America, it's just going to order guns because all of you have like a million guns on you at all times. At least
one in my back pocket right now.
You just order them all. You get a free gun with every book purchase, that kind of thing. And then it's going to use the guns to move around, just like his little crutches. There's no way to stop this thing from killing us all, Earl. Nice choice.
In fact, as I look at the picture, I'm recognizing that this thing has a minor resemblance to a Dalek.
That makes me want it all the more. Can you imagine doing this and giving it the little tennis balls, the half tennis balls all around? That would be awesome. That would be awesome.
Exterminate.
Totally. Anyway, it's a really cool choice, especially for this. If this doesn't get bid up, the idea that you could pick up something this cool looking for $150, like to me, that becomes like basically an impulse buy because this is a really cool piece of kit. If it stayed that low, I think it's going to get bid up a lot higher. But
I am pretty sure. In fact, this may be one of those cases where we break our own rule when we come back next time and talk about what
we just made the rule.
Well, rules are made to be broken. Isn't that
quickly? 5 minutes later.
We're rebels.
Rebels.
Rebels. Rebels without a bite.
So I was able to look through the YouTube comments, and luckily the jackals there and the guy have been able to discuss and answer each other's questions for the most part. But there was a good question from Rob asking, can you still have fun at Kansas Fest if you're not a hardcore Apple fanboy? And I answered that yes, I think
yes.
You can. But what do you say, Earl?
Yes, absolutely. Now, the Apple II was my first personal computer that I poked around with, but as people who've heard the podcast, Retrobits know, it isn't the one that I spent the most amount of time with. I would not consider myself an Apple expert or an Apple fanboy, and I had a great time at Kansas Fest. I think for two reasons. One is some of the things that they talk about in the presentations were actually more newsworthy to me, being a person who doesn't know expertly about the Apple II. So I learned stuff. Like there were a couple presentations on Apple II GS programming that I thought were really interesting to me. And the second reason is, you know, we've all been doing this for a long time, and even though the primary thing is Apple II, lots of the folks that I were talking to there are also not exclusively Apple II fanatics.
Almost
they
nobody
also,
is.
Don't tell anybody, but yeah. But they also like a lot of the old computers, and so it was just. And plus, it's a great social time. If nothing else, you're there with a bunch of people who have taken time out of their busy lives to come talk about retro computers, and there's a level of camaraderie that transcends the fact that you're there for a particular platform.
So yeah, I think people, I put in the comments that people can enjoy it because you went, Earl, and you had fun, and you're a dirty Commodore lover. So,
yes, exactly.
So everyone can have fun, even Earl.
Yep, I agree. So that's how I'd answer that. Any other comments that you want to speak to?
Nothing worth your ears.
All right.
Yeah, well, no, there's lots, but people are taking care of themselves. I'm trying to keep up.
Yeah, we're just delinquent, so, you know, people are being self-sufficient.
Right. Oh, other than one comment about your choice of your symbolic artificial intelligence, take over the world, dear Lord, don't arm it, eBoy choice, that it's like $760 shipping for at least one person who just looked. So
interesting.
That makes it because it's such a big item, that makes it less
right.
of an impulse item. So for that kind of thing, a lot of times it comes down to where it is, and when we're talking about big iron here, or relatively big iron, sometimes finding out, is it someplace close enough to you that you can maybe ask the person, can I swing by and just pick it up?
I think one of the frustrating aspects, you know, it's great that the retro computing hobby has gone worldwide, and like this podcast would show, people can connect with each other from anywhere to share their enthusiasm. But physical stuff doesn't do that yet. We don't have transporters. And so It's frustrating to me sometimes to look out and see things that it's like, wow, I'd love to have that, but holy crud, how do I get it here? Mm-hmm. You know, how do I get it to myself? For instance, there's a fella in the Bay Area who still to this day does servicing and sales of teletype machines. And wow. is probably one of the world's leading experts.
Because he's the only one.
And has an amazing warehouse of repair parts and that kind of thing for teletype machines. And maybe we'll try and look up that link for either this show or next show. Maybe I'll talk more about it. But I could get an ASR 33 teletype for a fairly reasonable price. I mean, one that had been refurbished and oiled and, you know, in really good shape. But the trick is how to get it from the San Francisco Bay Area up here to Portland. You know, it's the shipping thing.
Exactly. And that's another example of the kind of thing that one has to turn to one's significant other and justify, guess what I just purchased? That's going to use this much space in our house. And
yes.
Oh, I would think as much as like this artificial intelligence thing you've just picked, having that by the front door greeting me in an artificially intelligent way would be awesome. But having a teletype where I come in through the front door and there is already printed out any tweets that mention my handle and that kind of stuff.
And I would just tear off the roll paper.
Look at it. It's just like, come on. My life would be immeasurably improved by that.
It would be awesome. And yeah. The ASR 33 is what I used in high school. So I got to get me one of those.
Again, there's the nostalgia factor. I find when I'm picking something like that, I will usually go with the thing that I either had or the thing that I wanted versus even the thing that might have been the best in breed when we look back on it historically. The nostalgic pull outweighs a lot of other factors when it comes to my own purchases.
Yep. Yep, me too.
I think that's all the news we have, Earl. What else have you got to talk about?
I think so. So let me throw it over to you and just say from the retro computing realm, what's new? And how's your podcast going? How is the No Quarter?
No Quarter is going great. So Mike McGinnis and I have been knocking them out. We record earlier in the week. It's usually done on Wednesdays, but we recorded a bit later this week, and it's now done and ready. In fact, about 2 hours after this show is when the scheduled upload time is. So the next one where we discuss, I'm always a week ahead, so I don't want to talk about what did we discuss last time. We discussed Xevious. So the Xevious podcast will be coming out today. It's been really, really fun. I think Mike and I have a good complementary and very different sort of personalities, so it makes for an interesting show. So half an hour every week, comes out late Sundays. And it's just really fun to discuss the old coin-op machines and to play, you know, one game each week and him and I competing for high scores and stuff. So really having a good time doing that podcast.
And it's an audio podcast.
Yep, all audio, yes.
So it's interesting. How do you translate you've talked about drawing word pictures. You
yes.
must be good at conveying something that's inherently a audio-video kind of experience to just an audio medium. How do you do that?
It's kind of the same as I've done on those rare occasions where I put out a 1 megahertz. The same sort of thing where the only time that becomes an issue is when you're discussing the gameplay. And with the coin-op machines, unlike even maybe the Apple II games, when I'm discussing those, like the next Apple II one, which is now a few weeks overdue posting, where I'm giving away Castle Wolfenstein. My little baggied Castle Wolfenstein. But describing a video game for the home systems is sometimes more difficult than these coin-op machines because for the most part, and we've discussed this actually on the No Quarter episodes, coin-op arcade machines had to have, like to be successful, they not only had to have very simple controls and but they had to have the sort of gameplay that you can stand in front of and in 30 seconds get the point and say, you know what, I get it. Mm-hmm. I can throw a quarter in, I can do it. So that inherently makes them a little easy to describe because the nature of the game to have been successful has to be something that somebody could just get, you know, in a different culture, they don't even speak English, they stand in front of it holding their quarter and it convinces them to make that purchase just by looking at it. So it's that obvious and that apparent. So it does make it relatively easy to describe the gameplay mechanics, which we do in each episode. But then after that, we're more talking about the history of it and talking about things that happen in the future with the games and the collectability of various cabinets and that kind of stuff. And those are things that are just as easy to talk about as anything we do here on RCR.
Sure. Interesting.
Yeah.
anything else going on?
No. Other than I'm leaving this show for RCR. No, screw you. No Quarter sounds so good. I'm done with you, Earl.
That's it. I'm with you. Out of here. Well, so for me, I seem to not be able to keep my attention on any one thing for any particular amount of time. It's just there's so many fun things to do that I'm just, you know, and with the small amount of discretionary time I have, I just flop around all over the place. So my latest flopping was OpenVMS. I was able to take the hobbyist version of this operating system and get it installed on a couple different emulators, actually. One was the Personal Alpha emulator, which, as luck would have it, emulates an Alpha workstation.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, and, is that Alpha? That makes
sense. The other was the VAX version of VMS that you can emulate on SimH, which is a multi-system package of emulators that
emulate. I don't know that.
Oh, you haven't? Nope. SimH is very interesting. Emulates a variety of older systems, and in a lot of cases, there are already canned packages of software that you can download along with the SimH emulator.
How do I not know about this? I just Googled it, and it's like a whole thing.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
On version 3.9. I've missed a whole world. Look at this.
SimH is amazing.
It emulates everything.
And look at some of those systems that emulate some of the old classic
old IBM systems and, yep, and MIT stuff and Honeywell systems. And or why weren't you telling me about this before? You're a mean, mean friend.
Sorry.
Look at this. Holy crap. Everyone should run off and look at it. So it's at simh.trailing-edge.com. And I'll make sure we have a list, a link in the show notes. But really interesting. So it's, and it works well, does it?
It does. It does indeed. I love emulating a PDP-11 on it. It's nice because, you know, you can try things out on the emulator and goof around and not really mess up your installation. Mm-hmm. And then if those things work, then you could do it on the real thing.
That's the great joy of emulation. I do a lot of things in virtual machines for that exact reason, both at work and personally, because it's fun. You just have it. And if you completely trash it, well, I've got a whole saved state I can bring
back.
You got
a snapshot. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of wish my main computer was actually just everything should run as a virtual machine, even the main machine, and just constantly saving states. And
I've said that. I've said that that is actually one of the interesting aspects of – yes, you did. But I wonder who said it first. Let's get back to the archives. But, I mean, that's one of the interesting things to me about virtual desktop infrastructure, about VDI, is that, you know, if everybody's running in a virtual machine anyway, if they trash it out, then in 60 seconds, they're back up and running. So, but back to the SimH, yes, people should immediately check it out.
And we have a question. Jay Alexandra is asking in the comments, did you get your Multia working?
Well, no, I did not. I would say yes and no. I
would say yes if I was lying.
I got the Multia working in terms of getting a battery hooked up to it. What I didn't get working was it running with OpenVMS. And in further reading that I did, it seems that OpenVMS isn't an optimal choice for the Multia. The Multia, by the way, is a it can either be a Pentium or an Alpha-based workstation. My particular one is an Alpha Multia. It has a DEC Alpha chip in there as its brains. And the best operating system choice, it seems, is Windows NT for Alpha. So I happen to have a boxed NT 4.0. I can probably... Oh, I can't reach it, but it's sitting right
there.
Sure
you have it. Sure it is. I believe you. Sure.
And it's interesting. The Multia is made to run that. You can just go into the ROM and hit a couple keys and bang, it installs it. So that's probably what I'm going to do with the Multia. In terms of running OpenVMS on something, I'm looking for either a Alpha workstation or a old VAX server kind of system. Or maybe a VAX station, one of the old VAX workstations that eventually I'll run it on real iron. Right now I'm running it in an emulator and I'm very happy.
Right, cool.
And as I mentioned before, telnetting to it at the Living Computer Museum, a older version of VAX VMS, which is interesting in and of itself.
But yeah, and there's something to be said about that, because a lot of the ways in which I worked like I've done a lot of stuff on Vax VMS, and usually it wasn't me sitting down in front of the system like it's something remote. So
having
the account there would, in a lot of ways, be the most appropriate way for me to re-experience that in a nostalgic sense, is to have, no, the computer's in California and I'm here on a timeshare account. That sounds perfect. I don't need to buy it to get what I had before.
Right. You got it right there. And it's kind of fun to think, you know, you're remote. It's fun for me to think I've seen the system that I'm remoting into. I've seen it on the raised floor environment. You know, and so it's fun to think, ooh, I have access. Wow, boy, what I would have given for this as a kid.
Right, right. Yes, exactly.
So I guess that's it for the news. So I guess we're done unless there's any parting shots. If anybody wants to take any parting shots at us,
yes,
they always do. So remember, our next show is November 25th. Join us live, as some folks are doing, thank you very much, right now for the recording. Please help spread the word in forums, through tweeting, you know, skywrite it, whatever you want to do. You know, put up a poster for us at the coffee shop. Please do review us on iTunes, because that is a big help. If we get more stars over there, then we kind of buoy our way to the top. Go to rcrpodcast.com for links from this and our other shows. As Carrington mentioned, you'll want to go to look at our Retro Geek gift guide to buy a gift for yourself or for that retro geek in your life. Email and send audio feedback to the show at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And if you're not exhausted from doing all that other crud, then follow us on Twitter at RCR Podcast. And until next time, Retro Compute!